Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
I want you to join me and identify these samples from this very unique playlist of songs or musical compositions and ask yourself, what do they have in common?
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays. 'Cause no matter how far away you roam, and windy sea, when I come home to you, San Francisco,
I am a lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been
first, the artists in order were Aaron Copland, Harry Como, Tony Bennett, Glenn Campbell, and Helen Reddy. Their work spanned the eras from 1930 to 1970s music, yet their legacy is as timeless as the music itself. As we conclude this musical tribute, we reflect on the incredible legacies of these artists. What do they have in common? All these musical geniuses battled Alzheimer's disease, reminding us of the importance of continued research and support for those affected by this condition. So let their music inspire us to push forward in the fight against Alzheimer's, and may their melodies remain with us always. Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic and professor of healthcare science and policy at Arizona State University. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, the latest on Alzheimer's and why it's such a tough disease to cure. Then we continue our caregiver journeys. Joining us in studio is first an expert in Alzheimer's disease. He works at Mayo Clinic in Florida. He's a practicing neurologist there, Dr. Gregory Day. Dr. Day, welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Servin. Really appreciate being here.
We love having you here. And Dr. Melissa Murray. She is a professor of neuroscience, also at Mayo Clinic in Florida. Dr. Murray, welcome to our studios.
Thank you very much. Excited to be here.
Let's get right into this. Dr. Day, you've joined us in the past, and I'm going to start with a similar question like we've done in previous times to kind of set the stage for us. But explain the difference between Alzheimer's and other types of dementia.
Right. And it's appropriate for you to ask me that question multiple times because every single patient and family member in my office asks me that same question. And I think it's confusing for us because we are often going to use those terms interchangeably.
Right.
But when we talk about dementia, really dementia is simply the term that should replace or the term that we're going to use to describe any patient who has a change in memory and thinking when those changes lead to problems in daily life. So problems with memory and thinking that stop you from doing something that you couldn't do before, that you didn't have in the past, that's going to be a definition of dementia. When we talk about Alzheimer's disease, well, that's the number one cause of dementia. And Alzheimer's disease refers to changes in the brain that impair brain function to the point we're going to develop those symptoms, and most often symptoms to do with memory and thinking. So Alzheimer's disease dementia, or Alzheimer's dementia, is a dementia that's characterized predominantly by problems with memory and thinking that get worse over time. So they are different in a way, but often they're actually, we're talking about the same thing.
Got it.
If I can interrupt, one of the things that I find most helpful is if you visualize an umbrella,
yeah.
And if you think about dementia as literally that umbrella, and each of the different spokes could be different forms of dementia, with Alzheimer's disease being the most common, whether you're an older aged individual where you develop symptoms after 65 or even younger age, develop the symptoms before 65.
I love the analogy there. One thing that as we put together this show, our team, myself, is that we always are looking for health headlines. And I can comfortably tell you that in this area of Alzheimer's disease, we have plenty of headlines that compete with every other disease condition at this point. So I'm going to ask the question this way. I'm going to ask you, Dr. Murray, what are those recent advancements that are really maybe impressing you or that we should be like really highlighting in terms of the early diagnosis of this condition?
Such a good question. And it's one of the most important things as we keep looking earlier and earlier, because our goal is really what can we do to identify individuals even before they start to develop symptoms. So if we're talking about looking in, whether that's neuroimaging or the biofluids, one of the most exciting things is our advances within blood. So we want to be able to understand changes in an individual in an equitable way so that we could access this. People may not have access to facilities for big MRIs or big PET scans, but what's very important is these blood changes helps us on the research side, and we're still really developing our strong knowledge in that area. That will then go on to the clinic side to really give us a window into an opportunity. A lot of us will take blood draws when we go to the doctors, and we hope that one day we would have those types of opportunities for people, whether they're starting to show symptoms or even before they start to show symptoms.
I love that. Dr. Day, to kind of follow up on this point, there is a lot of discussion about these biomarkers that Dr. Murray's bringing up and how they may be used in diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Can you explain maybe where are we now? If they showed up to see you in clinic, what would you draw or what should you draw?
Yeah, good
to get that.
As Dr. Murray said, I think the advances in biomarkers, our ability to detect proteins related to changes in the brain that can tell us about disease in an individual, is a huge headline, and a headline that is already starting to change how we practice in the clinic. And so in the research setting, we might be looking in blood for any number of things. In the clinic, we're going to use our biomarkers. That's some marker, some protein, other chemical that we can measure to tell us about whether or what things might be contributing to a patient's symptoms, to the complaints that they have. And in particular, if it's my clinic, well, we're probably talking about memory complaints. And one of the key ways that we use biomarkers currently is to answer questions about specific questions like, is this problem with memory and thinking, this case of early dementia, is that due to the first changes in the brain related to Alzheimer's disease? We used to tell people that the only way we're going to know for sure is at a time of autopsy, where we look at brain tissue and the cells itself. And while autopsy and brain analysis at that level, we haven't replaced that. We're probably never going to replace that. We get such incredible detail looking there, and we can understand everything going on. Biomarkers actually allow us to say with confidence that we're going to see changes related to Alzheimer's disease in an individual today. So in my clinic, when we're talking about biomarkers, well, we're probably going to use neuroimaging. Dr. Murray mentioned that.
Okay.
Typically, that's going to mean a brain MRI, which, of course, we have access to at most of our hospitals, but still not universally available and certainly less available outside of developed countries. But we're also going to use some of these biofluid biomarkers. And for the longest time, the last 10 to 15 years, our experience has been focused on spinal fluid.
Right.
And so to do that, we got to do a lumbar puncture or a spinal tap to access that fluid. And in that fluid, we can learn about changes in the brain from measuring protein changes there, including proteins related to Alzheimer's disease. But we're looking and continuing to transition and looking for opportunities to say which of those spinal fluid tests or brain imaging tests might even be replaced by measures in blood.
Understood. Dr. Murray, one of the other areas that gets so much attention are the treatment options that have recently been approved. We know we have a couple drugs. They are designed, as I understand it, to eliminate this compound amyloid that we're going to talk about in a moment. Just yesterday, before this taping, the FDA wanted even more information on the latest version of that type of drug. So I guess the biggest question we want to know is that how effective are these treatments that are now available?
Such a good question. So when we look at these therapies, there are readouts that we want to be able to understand. Early days, we wanted to understand, does this impact how a person's thinking? Does it help improve their thinking? And more recently, with the advances of being able to look in the biofluids, whether that's in the blood or the spinal fluid or with the neuroimaging, we're really trying to root our understanding of these therapies with an outcome so that we could actually look at this. And there has been a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for some of our more recent therapies that have gone through FDA approval. And I'd like to kind of put it in context. The therapies of today are really the science of 10 years ago.
Oh.
And it takes so long for us to actually get to the point of having a therapy available to our patients. There's a very rigorous process that has to undertake. And so some of our more recent therapies may have side effects, and we want to understand those. And so that time delay is a very important one. I lost my grandmother to Alzheimer's disease, and one of the more recent therapeutics showed a difference of 6 months. If I had had 6 months more of her remembering
wow.
me,
wow.
it would have been incredible. And so one of the things to keep in mind is if we can have patience with the therapies, like not be a patient, but have the patience,
right?
They are making an impact. And we are making and kind of encouraging the excitement for all of these big drug companies to focus in, because for the longest time, they didn't see a change. And we're really actually starting to see even a modicum of change means a big difference to families.
I love hearing some hope in that regard. I'm going to kind of switch to a slightly different point. Dr. Day, there was a recent documentary on CNN. It was titled The Last Alzheimer's Patient, and it detailed how a patient with the risk markers for Alzheimer's were reversed by lifestyle modifications. Now, all due respect to the people who put together that documentary, it brought a lot of hope, but it also says that there are lifestyle things that we should be doing that could reverse this. I guess, you're an expert in this area. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that patient?
Of course.
And what does that mean?
Well, I think the key thing to recognize, I mean, the documentary is exciting, and we are all about hope and generating a message that applies and that all of us can apply to our day-to-day life. And I think most of us paying attention to that documentary can see ourselves in that patient. This is a healthy individual, first of all, who wasn't undergoing assessment for dementia, didn't have problems with memory or thinking, but was really having, I guess, what we might call a preventive health visit, looking for risk factors and asking that question, what can I change today so that I'm in better health, or at least as good health as I am tomorrow, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And in the course of what is a very thorough evaluation, that individual learned that they had risk markers for Alzheimer's disease and maybe even some changes on biomarkers that suggested the presence of Alzheimer's changes in the brain. So not symptoms of Alzheimer's yet, but markers of that disease. And through a comprehensive program, changes in diet, exercise, optimizing other aspects of health, controlling blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol, all the things that are difficult to do but possible with concerted effort, that patient, in their own experience with their doctor, showed improvement in overall health, and a decrease in those markers of Alzheimer's disease. So those biomarkers that we're talking about. What does the future hold for that individual? And we don't know. In 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I sure hope that the story has a happy ending and that his overall life is going to be a lot better for making these changes. What can we take away from that? Well, if you're sitting there wondering, what can I do to keep my brain healthier, to decrease my risk of Alzheimer's? Good news, you don't have to undergo a very thorough evaluation for that. We know that if we improve our diet, if we improve our propensity for exercise, we get out and we work out 3 or 4 times a week, total week count of maybe 75 minutes of moderate exercise, getting the heart rate up, we're going to see improvements in our future health and our current health and our energy level as well. Working with our family doctor, if your doctor's told you to control that blood pressure, to manage your cholesterol, your blood sugar, if you're snoring at night or your spouse is elbowing you awake because you're gasping, getting that evaluation for sleep apnea, treating those things today, I think are going to be important for all of us tomorrow. And large studies suggest that if we make those changes, we could reduce overall cases of dementia by about 30%. I mean, that's a pretty exciting return on investment. And that doesn't even count or tell you about the other benefits to your heart health, lung health, and general energy, which I think come with some of those same lifestyle interventions.
And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the latest on Alzheimer's disease, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. Dr. Murray, yet another headline that we covered extensively had to do with the APOE4 gene. And there was a study that showed that if you had both copies of this gene, you, at least per these authors, and you can correct me, your chance of getting Alzheimer's was significantly high, if not close to 100% for some ethnic groups. Can you comment on the significance of the APOE4 gene or the genetics as people will have curiosity about that?
Such a good question. Once again, the importance of evaluating and understanding a disease can be many ways. We talked just earlier about lifestyle. And one of the things we've often looked at is what is the genetic contribution? And so interestingly, about 90 to 95% of Alzheimer's disease isn't the frank type of genetics where we think about mutations, where it's a really severe change to your DNA that leads to almost an inevitability, especially in the younger individual. We can have risk factors like APOE4, and this is a heavily studied gene. So what does that mean if you are in possession of it? You want to be, some individuals go to get checked. It does increase your risk, but Dr. Day mentioned earlier, once again, there may be some modifiable factors, and it's one of the heaviest areas of research now. Can we fight our genetics in a sense? Global health, general health, feeling good, that physical activity, those are heavy areas of research. It does significantly increase your risk, and I think that individuals who are aware of that can take ownership. I found out that I had sleep apnea, and I've much younger than I should have been. And it shocked me because it leads to an increased risk. So what does risk really mean? If you have maybe this genetic change we're talking about or some type of difficulty with your lifestyle, you have potentially a chance to interfere. So I started working out. I had to lose some weight. I had to lose a lot more weight than I was planning to. But I actually ended up not having to have a CPAP. And I started feeling a lot more alert and less tired. So I made a decision about my life. In this instance with APOE4, this is something you can counsel with your doctor. It does not have to be an inevitability, but it is a very interesting aspect to the disorder.
Understood. I want to also stick to one other issue with regards to causation. There was a book published in 2021 covered by the New York Review of Books, a very august grouping, and they pointed out and they highlighted a book by Carl Harrop entitled How Not to Study a Disease, The Story of Alzheimer's. And in it, he argues that the research has lost its way because it's too in love with one theory, that's the amyloid for which the therapies we've been talking about seems to be studied and seems to be the cause. My question is this hypothesis, this idea of what causes Alzheimer's, is it valid? And are there others? And I'm open to both responses. Just because it got my attention when I saw that as a highlight that I normally don't hear counter issues.
Well, I can start with an opinion on it. So the amyloid hypothesis, I mean, what is that? It's we think that this protein amyloid is one of the first proteins to build up in the brains of individuals who will later go on to develop Alzheimer's disease. And every patient that has Alzheimer's disease is going to have this buildup of this protein in what we call those plaques in the brain. If you have a genetic mutation that affects how your body makes or gets rid of amyloid, you're at a very, very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And there are specific mutations that affect amyloid, and everyone with those are going to develop that disease. The APOE4 mutation you talked about, that's the body's mechanism for moving amyloid around. And so many different signs and symptoms or signs and factors point towards this amyloid hypothesis. But where I'm going to agree with Dr. Harrop, I think any time that we're still using the words hypothesis or theory, and we're not intentionally asking other questions, or we're focusing only on one question to the exclusion of other things, I mean, we may need a reset. And we certainly want to be thinking about other things that contribute and could explain this disease, could modify this disease, that might give us some other ideas about treatments that could really make a difference for our patients.
Dr. Murray, you want to add anything?
I'd love to add some things. Dr. Day makes such a good point. One of the things we have to always keep in mind as clinicians and scientists is a hypothesis is something that is still set to be tested. Mm-hmm. And it is very important for us to have a focus whenever we're evaluating our patients or looking under the microscope. So for me, my job is to look under the microscope. People lovingly donate their tissue, and it gives me the opportunity to look at these amyloid beta plaques or tau accumulating inside of neurons. And in the early days of Alzheimer's disease research, people who did not study amyloid beta would get shifted off to this tiny closet of a room, whereas the whole other conference would be dedicated to it. And so there became a myopia in the field, too much of a focus, too much of a narrow-mindedness. And so in that instance, Dr. Harrop, I think, hit the nail on the head, but it still is quite valid. There just may be a part of the full picture. And for too long, people just focused on that little part. It has led to some significant discoveries, but a lot of the emphasis was actually led because of this sort of imbalance in individuals who are destined to get the disease. But individuals who just get the disease and we're still not sure why, there are many things to be able to be focused upon that we are still, actually, the field has really moved forward in a dramatic fashion over this last decade. And so they're keeping a much wider and more open mind for sure.
So I want to, in our last moments, because I could spend hours with you guys on this, I want to point a question to each of you so that our listeners take away, like, you know, really at this moment in time when they're listening to it, what's the latest state of the art? What's your hope, or perhaps what should we all be paying attention to, since there's so much going on, whether it's olive oil or exercise or blood pressure, or therapy, where should we be putting our attention to? I'm going to start with you, Dr. Day.
Yeah, and I love the focus on headlines. We want to see these headlines transition to therapies, to treatments. We want the same things that our patients want. I think for me, what's most exciting right now actually brings together a lot of what we've been talking about. This idea that we have biomarkers, maybe even more accessible biomarkers and something easy to get as blood that can tell us about someone's future risk or current state even of changes that might predict and identify people at highest risk for Alzheimer's disease opens up the door to start treating and making interventions at an earlier and earlier time, even before symptoms arise. And in neurology, and particularly in Alzheimer's disease, we act like that's revolutionary, but that's what we do every day when we're going in to see our regular doctors. We're measuring our cholesterol. Right. We're treating our cholesterol often because we want to prevent heart disease. And ideally, we're going to treat it before we have a heart attack or another problem related to that. Well, now that we can find patients who may have changes in their levels of amyloid or other Alzheimer's-related proteins, there may be opportunities to change those proteins now and effectively create a situation where we prevent progression of the disease, and patients can go on to continue to age gracefully and age normally. And that's the focus of some big prevention clinical trials. It's not something that your family doctor is going to be doing for you at this point in time. But if those trials show us that if we start some treatments really early in high-risk people, those people don't develop the symptoms of the disease, you can bet that we'll be getting colonoscopies, cholesterol tests, and blood tests for markers of Alzheimer's disease in just about no time. So I'm really keeping tabs on that line of research, on that clinical trial, and that whole field of practice.
I love the hopeful vision for it. Dr. Murray, I'm going to give you the last word.
Thank you very much. So if I put on my listener hat, I'm going to go start taking a 20-minute walk at sunset, maybe a few times a week. Get out there. It'll change your world. If I'm putting on my scientist hat, one of the most exciting things that we're working on is just like how we're mapping all the stars in the galaxy. We're working really hard to map all the cells in the brain.
Wow.
Like the Hubble telescope for the brain. And so what my lab does is use super fancy microscopes to dive in deep and try to give every cell an identity to understand how I might be able to change the fate of that cell.
I love the sense of hope you've left us both with. I need to get you both back to join us every so often so that we can kind of make heads or tails of just so much going on here. Thank you so much, Dr. Day. He is a practicing neurologist and a specialist in Alzheimer's disease. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure.
And also Dr. Melissa Murray. She is a professor of neuroscience. This is her area of research specialty. And they're both from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Melissa, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for giving your listeners hope.
You bet. Up next are weekly medical headlines. Then we continue our caregiver journeys. And we'll be right back.
Oh, but you're lovely. With your smile so warm and your cheek so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you.
Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servant, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare administration and policy. This is What's Health Got to Do with It. These are your weekly health headlines. First, whooping cough, a dangerous bacterial illness particularly harmful to infants, is on the rise in the U.S. Health officials report nearly 5,000 cases in the first 5 months of this year, more than double the number from the same period last year. Experts believe that the drop in mask wearing and social distancing, combined with missed vaccinations during the pandemic, has contributed to this resurgence. Clusters have been reported in Kentucky, Oregon, and Pennsylvania. Whooping cough starts with symptoms like a cold, but can worsen into severe coughing fits, posing a significant threat to babies. Next, medical experts have identified a new sexually transmitted fungal infection, ringworm, in New York City. This marks the first case of trichophyton mentagrophytes type 7 in the U.S. The infection was found in a man who had traveled to California, England, and Greece. Doctors are now on high alert for this highly contagious skin infection. In other news, a clinical trial is starting to test the effectiveness of combining the anti-malaria drug tofenaquin with other medications to treat babesiosis. This is a tick-borne disease. With the spread of deer ticks, the main source for spread to humans, babesiosis cases have surged, making new treatment options crucial. The trend of at-home medical testing is booming, driven by Silicon Valley startups. While convenient, these tests raise concerns about accuracy and delayed medical care. The FDA is tightening regulations to ensure safety and reliability in this fast-growing industry. Lastly, a new study warns against drinking alcohol on airplanes. Researchers found that the combination of low oxygen levels and alcohol can significantly strain your heart and reduce sleep quality. experts advise avoiding alcohol during flights to stay healthy and well-rested. Those are your weekly health headlines. As caregiving is on the rise, we continue our special segment on caregiver journeys. Our goal is to share stories from the front line in caregiving so that we focus on the solutions and not the problems. Joining us today is Dr. Amy Hessler. She's a practicing neurologist here in Jacksonville, Florida, who's been involved in the care of her dad, Dan, a Vietnam War vet who has metastatic prostate cancer, complicated by a history of strokes, one of which left him with some dense language problems. He lives in Bradenton. She's joined by her stepmom, Letha Smithson Hessler, a retired vocational rehab counselor and mental health care manager who's caring for her husband, Amy's dad. Dr. Hessler, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me again, Joe.
You bet. And Letha, welcome to our show as well.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's a pleasure. Amy, I'm going to start with you. Dr. Hessler, can you share with us a little bit about your experiences as a caregiver or helper for your father?
Sure. So I'm going to say that my stepmom, Letha, who you'll meet in a few minutes, is the day-to-day caregiver. But really, this journey really started abruptly March 8th of 2020, when my dad had, unfortunately, which was his fourth stroke. And I was actually at his bedside. And so as a neurologist, I'm sure, Joe, you can imagine how scary this would be, because I knew a lot about what was going on. And he went into the bathroom in this hospital where he was hospitalized and was taking a long time. I found him in the bathroom having a stroke, being unable to speak and being paralyzed on the right side of his body, unable to get off the commode. So he had this major stroke. Fortunately, the blood clot that caused the stroke dissipated, and the weakness on the right side of his body went away. But what he was left with was an inability to speak. And so my dad is a writer and is very verbose, and that was a devastating thing for him to have. And this was March of 2020, right as the pandemic was starting. So things were so really up in the air and starting to really shut down. And so that's how things started. Over the next 2.5 months, you know, it was a journey because it was the pandemic, and he was at Haley in Tampa in rehab, and has started having had some complications. And unfortunately, my stepmom, Letha, wasn't able to go in because of COVID restrictions.
Sure.
So that's how this started. It was the scariest day of my life as a neurologist and as a daughter.
Wow. Letha, I want you, if you could, to describe your role in caregiving and your typical day. Give us a sense of that.
Well, I'm Dan's caregiver and advocate. He reminded me today I'm his advocate, too.
That's right.
So it depends on the day. If it's a stay-at-home day so that he doesn't have any appointments outside the house, the agenda is one thing. If it's a day we have to go up to the VA for an appointment, it's sort of different. But basically, I'm up and I take my first medication and I set a timer for an hour so I remember to take the next one.
Right.
Then I check Dan's vitals. I record them. I make sure his BP is at a certain place. Then I can give him his meds, his morning meds. Then I prepare him for what is called a Lovenox injection. I set another timer for 30 minutes because he needs lidocaine, which numbs the area a little bit. I usually then do my morning wash up, and then I get down to my desk and sit down and see what things have to be done or attended to today. I make sure Dan's got some coffee, water, because we're really pushing fluids these days.
Sure.
I make sure when he's ready, I give him his Glucerna, which is to keep his nutrition up, and we add other stuff to it, so it's more like a smoothie. If Janet is here, which is our home health aide, she'll make him his Glucerna, and that leaves me more time to work at the desk, which is usually stuff I need to get done, like setting appointments, rescheduling appointments if they need to happen, follow up on phone calls or emails to doctors, order meds, that kind of thing. I'm involved in all of that. Let's see. If she's here, she helps change his sheets, does some of the laundry, helps with cleaning the bathrooms. If she's not, then that's all mine. So I'll end up doing that. I do cooking. If he needs a lunch, or then we have to figure out what to give him. Usually it's eggs, more eggs.
Right.
And then the afternoon is somewhat free to get things done. Like if I have to do grocery shopping and I have someone coming in, I go do the grocery shopping, or I order from groceries in. Then a little later, I also, if it's a shower day, we try and get him in the shower 3 times a week, but usually we're good at 2. Then I let him know it's time for a shower. I give some cues because it takes him a while.
Sure.
He's pretty well, as Amy says, in his chair a lot. He's sort of stuck in his chair.
I see.
And doesn't move around the house too much.
Lisa,
so getting ready for a shower.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, what happens, I'm going to, like, ask about, like, what happens in the middle of the night, things of that sort.
Oh, well, middle of the night is usually calm, but it's really funny. If he's going to the bathroom, I don't hear him. But the minute he calls my name, I'm up. And so then I have to attend to whatever's going on. He may have fallen, or his blood sugar sometimes will go too low, and then we have to address that, give him stuff to bring it back up, because we've had that happen before. And so it just depends.
Letha, I'm listening to this, and the vibe I'm getting, this is a 24/7 every, I don't hear a lot of breaks for you, is the easiest way for me to put it, even with what we've heard so far.
Yeah. Well, it is. I say my day is done when Dan finally gets in bed, and then he quits looking at his phone and he rolls over and says goodnight.
Wow.
And then my day is done.
Wow. I'm curious, are you retired for your other work, or are you also working in somehow in between this?
No, I luckily retired, because I would have had to retire. I mean, it really is a full-time job, and it's gotten more as he's had more strokes, because he's now had 4.
Wow.
So, and with the treatment for his prostate cancer, he's even more tired than he was before. And that's really hard, because he needs lots of help.
I get it. And Letha, and I heard you mention that you have someone who comes in, but how much extra help besides you do you have?
I'm really lucky, because I'm in a program with the VA for caregivers.
Okay.
And so I get not only some home health aid time, where she can help me with some household tasks, but I can get respite hours. So I'm getting... And I use my respite hours every week. I get a set amount per year, but I figured out how much I need a week, so it goes throughout the year. So Janet's here 5 days a week, a little more time, like 4 hours. I think we're doing like 15 to 16 hours now.
Wow.
A week. And that allows me to leave the house for my doctor's appointments, or it allows me to go to the grocery store, like I said, or even to go out with a friend for lunch every once in a while.
Got it.
And really, Janet's become a member of their family. And, you know, luckily we've had her for a couple of years, right, Letha?
Yeah, yeah. And she's great with Dan because with his speech difficulty, she will sit down next to him and just talk to him, get him engaged, which helps his socialization as well as his speech, because the more he talks, the better it gets.
Amy, I'm going to ask you this. I know I've just heard this from Letha. We all have. It's a lot of work. How do you kind of work this in, or what role do you get to play in all of this in the care of your dad, who is obviously under great care? But how does it work for you?
Well, I mean, I'm very, very blessed, and I know it to have Letha. I mean, I really think that my dad is still here because of the care that Letha has provided. And I know not everyone has that. But personally, you know, what happened, what I shared at the beginning, what happened on March 8th of 2020, and him having this devastating stroke that took his speech, really was a turning point for me personally. I at that time I was living for 12 years. I lived in Lexington, Kentucky, which is a beautiful horse country and beautiful part of the country. But I just knew that I needed, in this sandwich phase of life, raising children, but having aging parents, that I needed to be closer to my parents. And besides my father, my mom also recently, I moved her up to Jacksonville within 5 minutes of me, so I could help her as well. But made a major decision in July of 2021. My family moved to Jacksonville, Florida. So it's about 4 hours from my dad and Letha in Bradenton, but I'm within driving distance. I'm not, you know, 900 miles away like I was in Lexington. So, you know, I'm the support person. I mean, Letha and I have some great, very honest, open conversations. She's, as you've heard, she's does an amazing job, and I've told her. And
yeah, to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about caregivers' journeys, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Amy, I'm curious, like, you know, this is, there's you, there's Letha involved. Are there other family members, and how does communication work around these issues?
Well, my brother, so it's just my brother and I, and, you know, my brother does come and visit, but, you know, it's really Letha and I are, well, I mean, Letha on the day-to-day standpoint, and then me as the supporting role is kind of how I consider myself in helping Letha and being able to spend time with my dad. You know, I feel, you know, a lot of people lose their parents at this stage of life where I am, and, you know, I'm just very blessed that I still have both of my parents, even though, you know, we all, as I tell patients, Joe, I'm not sure if you tell them something similar, but, you know, we can't change our age, we can't change our family history, so everyone's going to age or we're not here. So I feel really blessed to be able to have this time and with both my parents.
I get it, and I so agree. Letha, I'm going to ask you kind of a personal question, and one that I get anytime we talk about caregiving, and that's financial. Is there anything that you feel comfortable sharing about the financial part of caregiving? Anything, any strategy or anything that our listeners could actually benefit from that you learned in with this experience?
Well, I do a lot of automatic payments.
Sure.
So I don't have to think about things. Well, and financially, though, we're really blessed. Dan is service connected, so we get money from the VA. And because of the program we're in, I also now get a stipend. Before that, I just had to really watch things. I had to limit how much time. If I want to go somewhere or I need extra help on a weekend, I have to pay another person to come. And that expense has gone up. I also look for free help from friends sometimes to come and sit with Dan for an hour or two if I need to go and Janet's already gone home for the day. So, and I know there's some financial help, but there's not a lot, which is a real problem for folks.
Understood. Amy, as a physician, as a neurologist, and you've brought this up a few times, how has this shaped how you take care of your patients? Has it changed anything in terms of advice or approach since you yourself find yourself literally intimately involved here?
It has. I actually went from academic neurology in a big academic institution in Kentucky to private practice. And I made that very deliberate decision to not work in the hospital and have weekends off to be able to, be a caregiver, a support person for my parents, and also taking care of my children. And as I evaluate patients with dementia, I feel like I can relate with what their adult children are going through because I'm living it. And I see, and I do think that this experience has made me a better neurologist. Letha mentioned something about my dad spending a lot of time in his armchair. One of his first stroke actually affected a part of the brain that is the right frontal lobe that is motivation. So I kind of explain it as it's the armchair effect. He has things, he explained it to me that, he has things he wants to accomplish, but he just doesn't have that get up and go to get out of that armchair. And, again, that stroke, it's interesting. And I've reflected a lot on this because that stroke, I didn't recognize that he had a stroke as a neurologist, because he didn't have any weakness or speech difficulty with that first one. My dad actually perceived that he was depressed. And actually, Letha and I've talked a lot about this, that some of his abilities to hang pictures, organize a room, some of that, was just lacking in retrospect. But it wasn't until he had his second stroke, and I actually had a neurologist in Tampa call me and said, when did he have the big right frontal stroke? When did he have the first stroke? And I said, what first stroke? This current one, number two, was his first stroke, but in fact, it was actually a second one. So, we think of strokes as people having difficulty speaking or weakness, but it can have lots of different manifestations. So I guess back to your question, Joe, I feel like this experience in, walking alongside my dad and both my parents has made me a better doctor because I can understand these things from a personal standpoint.
Letha, in our final moment, I know that we have many listeners out there who will be basically very much seeing themselves through your experience. In many ways that they will very much identify with you. What insights do you want to make sure they take away from our conversation today, especially if they're just starting out in this experience?
Keep your friends so you have people to talk to. If you find yourself too depressed or getting depressed or really anxious, seek help. Use your resources. There's stuff online. There's the Alzheimer's Association. There's the County on Aging. There's also, what I do is I keep a book so that I write down on Dan what his diagnoses are, what medications he takes, all his doctors, and I take it to every appointment, and I always take it to the hospital. It helps keep me organized and informed, and it helps the doctors too. I also find that really organizing time for myself is important, so that I can rest if I need to, as well as I found other stress relievers that help.
Letha, I want to thank you for your time and for sharing your story with us. Amy, thank you as well for being so generous with your time and sharing your experience with the care of your dad. Godspeed to both of you guys.
Thanks so much for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
It has been a sincere honor to hear your story. We've been talking to Dr. Amy Hessler, a practicing neurologist here in Jacksonville, Florida, and Letha Smithson Hessler, Amy's stepmother and caretaker for Amy's father, Daniel, who has a history of strokes and metastatic prostate cancer. They've been sharing their caregiver journeys. And if you or someone you know would like to share your caregiver story, please contact us at health@wjct.org. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckman. Stacey Bennett is our producer. Brady Corum is our director. Jamie Vallee is our associate producer. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tag me on X or LinkedIn at Jay Servin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.